excited to welcome Ray Armantrout, a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, to read from and discuss her newest book, Partly. Armantrout has written 15 books of poetry and been published in a number of esteemed anthologies and poetry journals since she published her first book, Extremities, in 1978. In 2010, she won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry for her book, Versed. She's a professor of poetry and poetics at the University of California, San Diego, and she was one of the founding members of the original West Coast group of language poets. So to say that she is accomplished is an immense understatement. We're so excited to have her here with us tonight. So without further ado, please welcome Ray Armantrout to the stage.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. It compiles work from my books from 2001 to 2015. So obviously I'm not going to read all of it. I have to go kind of at light speed through my recent or semi-recent career. So it starts with new poems, and I'll read, I don't know, maybe six of those, and then I'll maybe one, two, three per book after that, and then a few poems that were written since. Not all of these, but some. This one from the new section I wrote shortly after coming back from Hong Kong, which was a very strange experience. So it kind of contrasts, it has sections that contrast Hong Kong with San Diego. Exchange. City of the future, in which each subway station stairs lead to the ground floor of a casino mall. What counts is the role defined for each piece by a system of rules saying how it can move, not the stuff the piece is made of. In the intersection, a muscular, shirtless man with small American flags tied to each wrist so that he looks like a wrestler, pushes, no, shoves, then catches a stroller piled high with plastic bags. His stuff. City of the future, where a tramway to the top of a peak opens onto a wax museum in which Michael Jackson extends one gloved hand. Hong Kong is a strange place. This, on the other hand, is based on a billboard I was seeing all over New York on the taxis. Easily, the models in the Gentleman's Club ad are posed with pink mouth slack, eyes narrowed to slits. Show me stunned resentment, the way the world absorbs an insult it won't easily forget. And this is set up like a math problem, like a word problem in math. Our favorites, right? Word problems. If a fat man with one earlobe distended by a large ring and a thin man in a heavy neck chain sit together checking email, the real is made up of things minus appearance. Near eucalyptus strands of green crescents and their shadows, flighty half moons, while the soul is made up of appearance minus things. Life's work. Did I say I was a creature of habit? I meant the opposite. I meant behavior is a pile of clothes I might or might not wear. Before all the sowing and reaping could go on for centuries, before the calendar, I must have been convinced that my movements were both mandated and blessed. I've never been an old woman knitting by a fire, but I've played one in images where it meant being foolish or wise, a mistress of distractions in direction. To rock while entwining is life's work. But I am reckless, restless. The ether. We're out past the end game where things get fuzzy, less thingy. Though in past times we practiced precision, concrete as a slot machine. But to be precise, you need to stop a moment, which turns out to be impracticable, and besides, speed is of the essence. Don't worry, of can take care of itself. And it's fine to say essence now that it's understood to mean ether, a kind of filler made either of inattention or absorption somewhere near the plank length. Sockets. You feed yourself frothy maple Greek moose whip, each bite a virgin. Promiscuity and sloth no longer sins after what you've done. Or you have perfect understanding of past events, which no longer seem unjust. Your oh, a spear, a song. But in the afterlife, roots rip from your sockets, new brains in their tips, scouting for water. That reminds me to drink some. Slide down a cliff face slowly, not falling, but softening its colors. I'll wait. Or if shadows bend and straighten repeatedly and the intervals between are not fixed, if the sun clears the wall behind me and the little table brightens, if the background is still while the foreground is in motion, or if it's the other way, I'll wait. And then this is from Up to Speed. Almost. Almost all the words we've said to one another are gone. And if they were retrieved verbatim, we might not acknowledge them. But the tenor of our talk has been constant across decades. Tenor is what we meant by soul. For instance, the way we joke by using non sequiturs, elliptical remarks, which deliberately suppress context in advance of time's rub out. When size really counts, the billboard says, showing the product tiny in one corner, so we need to search for it. Come find me. I stand behind these words. Two, three. Sad fat boy in pirate hat. Long, old, dented, copper-colored Ford. How many traits must a thing have in order to be singular? Echo persuades us everything we say has been said at least once before. Two plump, bald men in gray t-shirts and tan shorts are walking a small bulldog, followed by the eyes of an invisible third person. The Trinity was born from what we know of the bitter symbiosis of couples. Can we reduce Echo's sadness by synchronizing our speeches? Is it the beginning or end of real love when we pity a person because in him we see ourselves? The subject. It's as if we've just been turned human in order to learn that the beetle we've caught and are now devouring is our elder brother, and that we are young prince. I was just going to click on Phoebeus changed into a mermaid tomorrow, when suddenly it all changed into the image of a citizen watch. If each moment is in love with its image in the mirror of adjacent moments, as if matter stuttered, then of course we're restless. What is a surface, we ask, trying to change the subject? I always do this. I like this jacket, but now I have to take it off. A resemblance. As a word is mostly connotation, matter is mostly aura, halo, the same loneliness that separates me from what I call the world. Quiet, ragged skirt of dust encircling a ceramic gourd. Lookalikes, are you happy now? Would I like a vicarious happiness? Yes, though I suspect yours of being defective, forced. Scumble. What if I were turned on by seemingly innocent words such as scumble, pinky, or extrapolate? What if I maneuvered conversation in the hope that others would pronounce these words? Perhaps the excitement would come from the way the other person touched them lightly and carelessly with his tongue. What if of were such a hot button? Scumble of bushes. What if there were a hidden pleasure in calling one thing by another's name? Unbidden. The ghosts swarm. They speak as one person. Each loves you. Each has left something undone. Did the Palo Verde blush yellow all at once? Today's edges are so sharp they might cut anything that moved. The way a lost word will come back unbidden. You're not interested in it now, only in knowing where it's been. Integer. One what? One grasp? No hands. No collection of stars. Something dark pervades it. Metaphor is ritual sacrifice. It kills the lookalike. No, metaphor is homeopathy. A healthy cell exhibits contact inhibition. These temporary credits will no longer be reflected in your next billing period. Dark meaning not reflecting, not amenable to suggestion. Now we're all the way into the book Money Shot. Soft money. They're sexy because they're needy, which degrades them. They're sexy because they don't need you. They're sexy because they pretend not to need you, but they're lying, which degrades them. They're beneath you, and it's hot. They're across the border, rhymes with dancer. They don't need to understand. They're content to be, not mean, which degrades them and is sweet. They want to be the thing in itself and the thing for you. Miss thing, but can't. They want to be you, but can't, which is so hot. These next two poems have something to do with physics. I've got into a phase that lasted some years of reading popular books about physics and, you know, trying to glean something from them, which is hard, but also just kind of reacting off the language. Dress up. To be dressed is to emit virtual particles. The spirit of renormalization is that an electron all by itself can have infinite mass and charge, but when it's dressed, a toddler stares at us till we look up. Flirtatious, we call it. She waits until we get the joke about being here, being there. Supposedly they can be in two places at once. Okay, and this one I wrote after a conversation with an actual astrophysicist, and he was nice enough to meet with me. We sort of became friends, but this was our first meeting, and I thought I had some questions for him, and I don't think he understood my questions, probably because they weren't really well-posed questions, and I really didn't understand what he said. So afterwards, I kind of wrote, this is not an account of our conversation, which is why that I didn't really remember, but it's sort of like a feeling of it. And there's at least two voices in it, maybe three. Because a Scientific American article comes in and starts chalking it towards the end. So. Anyway, account for Brian Keating. Life was on its way from nothing to nowhere. Light was all business. Light was full speed when it got interrupted. Interrupted by what? When it got tangled up and broke into opposite. Broke into brand new things. What kinds of things? Drinking cup. Thinking of you. Convenience valet. How could speed take shape? Hush, do you want me to start over? The fading laser pulse, information describing the fading laser pulse, is stored, is encoded in the spin states of atoms. God is balancing his checkbook. God is encrypting his account. This is taking forever. I like to read this poem now because it was written maybe 4 years ago, but it has a section that features Donald Trump. You'll recognize it when we get there. It's about the third section, I guess. Arrivals. Sign in the airport. It's not how much cloud, but what kind. Welcome. We don't play requests, but we don't play bagpipes either. We figure that's fair. That's the bad boy sass of globalization kickstarting you on Clear Channel, where even the spin gets spun. Here's one. The devil is a blousy, failed executive who fires burnouts, star after star. Every known object rotates as if B, keeping busy, C, stunned. He only has a good appearance, but little did I know that it would become a big part of our lives. Okay, and this I wrote because I was asked to contribute to an anthology, a book, where poets were going to rewrite sonnets by Shakespeare. And of course, my first response was, no, no, are you insane? But then they assigned me Sonnet 3, and it's not one of the super famous ones, so I read it and I thought, well, this is really strange. It's one of those early ones where he's talking to a young man, and he's telling the young man how handsome and attractive the young man is, but he's kind of turning it around to, and so you should get married and have children. And, you know, it just seems so, such a convoluted logic. Like, is that just like the most indirect way of saying I'm attracted to you? Or is he speaking for someone else who really has an investment in the young man having children? Like, is his father the is his patron the father of the young man who wants? I'm no expert, so I don't know. But so what I did was take the possible explanations and kind of conflate them in the grossest way. So Sonnet 3. Your dad told me to tell you how good you look to him right now. Check yourself out. I'm sure you do. You're a very pretty boy. But the thing is, that won't last. Have you ever seen a pert old man? An insouciant septuagenarian? I thought not. They're invisible. And you'll be invisible too. What will your dad have to look at then? Do you think growth rebounds each year? Wrong. It has to be outsourced. Sublet. Get with the program. Your dad will be watching. And this I also see as having kind of two voices. I wrote it when I was going to a meditation class, but you know, having second thoughts, I guess, as always. Control. We are learning to control our thoughts, to set obtrusive thoughts aside. It takes an American to do really big things. Often I have no thoughts to push against. It's lonely in a song about outer space. When I don't have any thoughts, I want one. A close-up reveals that she has chosen a plastic soap dish in the shape of a giant sea turtle. Can a thought truly be mine if I am not currently thinking it? There are two sides to any argument, one arm in each sleeve. Maybe I am always meditating, if by that you mean searching for a perfect stranger. Okay, that's all from the book, but I'm going to read a few newer poems because, you know, it takes a while for books to be published. So that's like all old to me now. I'm not going to read all of these, but pick some. Okay. Okay, sometimes I'm asked to give what's called a craft talk, where you talk about how to write poetry and how you write poetry and how someone else should write poetry, you know. I'm always really ambivalent about that because, I mean, I have thoughts about it, but I'm not sure that I believe my thoughts very much. So I had a little bit of fun with that. And all of these things that I say, I kind of believe and kind of don't, as you'll see. The craft, and it's kind of in prose, they're really long lines. The craft talk. So that the best thing you could do, it seemed, was climb inside the machine that was language and feel what it wanted or was capable of doing at any point, steering only occasionally. The best thing was to let language speak its piece while standing inside it, not like a knight in armor, exactly, not like a mascot in a chicken suit. The best thing was to create in the reader or listener an uncertainty as to where the voice she heard was coming from, so as to frighten her a little. Why should I want to frighten her? Seemed like a good idea at the time. Arch. Like an arched eyebrow, traveling alone, you drift, seahorse, a forgotten, persistent question. Despite your skeptical attitude, it's true that your numbers are crashing. Still, you are rumored to consume up to 3,000 baby shrimp per day. Who doesn't want to be a revenant, to go back to basics in a big way, on the small screen, which somehow still survives? Terrific and terrible are cousins, after all. Am I warm or cold? I'm half rhyming, aiming right between quick and dead, like we could thread that needle and keep going. Object permanence. What if the ability to capture emblems in the wild won't validate us? What if displaying our embarrassing flaws won't save us, say being dead but kittenish? I can't show you anything new, not even an empty room behind a velvet rope. Least of all that. There's a Lexus spinning in a parking lot, because a mountain road is so cliche. It's throwing up dust, then more, but you know the car is still in there, somewhere, still voguing. Fusion. When we recognize, we think again, without knowing what or if we thought before. I confuse copper with brass. To recognize is almost always a pleasure. Perhaps it is pleasure itself. I confuse Melissa with Melissa. To recognize is not only to give something a name, but to give it the very name that was waiting for it somewhere. As if thing and name had been sad without each other. That's a woman in an Arctic fox costume singing, "Don't you worry about a thing, baby." I confuse worry with darkness in the shape of leaves flows over a building, black ellipses on the bay, slipping and falling into place. Flicker. When it was them, our parents, dying, the way they tried to deny what was happening, the way they were angry at the wrong things, seemed of a piece with the way they'd always been wrong about us, we thought. The way they were wrong about the world, which they saw only through the haze of their own swath of the past. So that it seemed natural for us to scoff inwardly, even at their deaths. But now it was one of us threatening to get up and walk out of the hospital on his withered legs, sheer sticks, because it was killing him. Clouds of methane rise from dumps outside our city as I drop a square of soft cheese through a slot into the bin marked landfill. Of course. course I feel bad about feeling good, about feeling bad about this. But as time speeds up, everything will flicker. This one also features Trump a bit, but more recently. Return. Better to collect miniature trolls beside toy bridges and arrange them on doilies. Best we commemorate old fears until our heads are full, lest we trump up some flesh and blood devil. Yep. Someone's been walking on your grave. You have seen yourself unexpectedly in a mirrored door. Though some have claimed it's pleasant to leave your body, then return. Now you return his gaze. Hate. The market hates itself just as much as you hate it. Look, in this spread for leather products, a stern-faced man in pink pants and a bomber jacket stands on satin sheets in front of leopard print wallpaper, holding a small briefcase or purse. The market hates you even more than you hate yourself. And this one is based on a William Carlos Williams poem that I like. You know, I like Williams a lot, but this one poem always annoyed me. His poem is called The Widow's Lament in Springtime. That's about a woman, probably his mother, whose husband has died, and so she's kind of contemplating suicide. But I wrote this called Old Woman's Lament in Autumn. When his poem starts, sorrow is my own yard. Sorrow is my corner store, where jack-o'-lantern balloons get high on the last helium. The end cap is gold today, with numbered bags of Werther's originals. No one is Werther. Last night a newscaster mentioned an elderly victim. Don't call me that. I'm old and obdurate. Unquote. Take this cup away from me with its hint of ammonia and dill, oak or corrosion. Who knows, really? What might ammonia taste like to a different person? Roll that question around on your tongue. You've heard it before, or something like it. The familiar is enormous, red-shifted. I'm happy to think of this deep sleep, the sleep of the dead, as a guilty pleasure I am getting away with. Okay, just two more. Whew. Can you see flag lolling on its pole like a dog's tongue? Start over. Flag lolling lewdly on its pole, then getting up, sending ripples through pupils, wanton. Is that what you'd say you saw? What traipsed through, careless, bouncing off the walls? If I'm sure of anything, it's that I'm a spot between tart and orange, taut and rough. I'm where they first touched, though they don't touch, they align. I'm a chimera factory. With us, it's about choices. How many kinds of kind bar will we want? An abandoned pillow in dry grass says enough, but not too much. It might be a poem. In our thrillers, a protagonist must be convinced that events concern her. Could she be involved? With us, it's about blast radius. Maple pecan is burnt ochre.
and safe. Okay, that's all for poetry.
I'm curious what physics books you were reading.
Well, let me see if I can remember. Of course, I read, Brian Greene, The Elegant Universe, and The Fabric of the Cosmos, and I read a book by Brian Cox that I liked a lot, but I'm trying to remember the name of it. Read a lot of Scientific American articles. That's all I can think of right now, but there were more. Do you read physics?
Sometimes.
What ones do you like?
I guess this is astrophysics, but yeah. Stephen Hawking.
Right, about brief history of time. I read that one a long time ago. Yeah, it's true. Forgot that. Okay, anybody else? Huh?
Yeah, let's say... The nightmare comes true, and Trump becomes president. And he asks you for an inauguration poem.
He's going to kill the poets, I think. That's not going to happen. I think he's going to, defund the NEA, right? There's not going to be any. I mean, I hate inauguration poems anyway. I think that they, But I also, hate the way that he would hate the arts, I think. Which one would I read? I might have to come up with a whole other one about him in that case. I heard, if we just want to have a general chat, that now Nate Silver says he's up to having about a 40% chance of winning. So. Unbelievable. Okay, but we can't just talk about that. So.
What books have you been reading recently?
Okay. That's both interesting and boring at the same time. You won't believe this first one. I've been reading Harry Potter in Spanish because I think it's a good way to improve. I'm going to Argentina. I did this before when I was going to Spain because I kind of can visualize the characters. I sort of know the plot in general, and so that helps. And then, I never read it in English because it's too childish, but in Spanish it's perfect for me. If you want to talk about poetry, I've read Rodrigo Toscano's An Explosion in Springfield, which I like a lot. I'm going to be teaching it pretty soon. And Monica Yoon's new book, I think, is really great. And Linda Ginian's book, The Unfollowing, I really liked a lot. And then I really enjoyed rereading Middlemarch recently.
Do you have thoughts on having published this book of the difference between print and online publications? And do you have feelings about publishing new poems in the way that, in a just online fashion, is there anything gained and lost in that?
Well, gained and lost, yes, both. I mean, I think more people see them if you publish online, actually, than see. I mean, unless the print you're talking about The Nation, or maybe Poetry Magazine. If it's not that, then if it's some other literary magazine that's only print, then you're going to have a relatively small audience. And maybe that's okay, you know, if it's a community, if it's like a within your city and within your town and within your community, and those people see it and they know each other, and you know. But I mean, just in terms of numbers, probably more people are going to see it online. On the other hand, there's something about having an object that lasts, that you can refer back to, that you can put on your shelf, that you can find something you liked again. I mean, I guess you can do that on the internet, but I don't. I don't know that I can't, maybe, but I don't. Some of each, probably. Whereas, you know, if I like a certain magazine and I like the people who are in it, I can save that and I can shelve it and go get it again. So, you know, there's something for that, something to be said for that.
How do you feel about being identified as a language poet? Like, what does that mean to you? And looking back on language poetry as a movement, like, how do you see yourself in that?
Well, I think that it, again, you know, it was a community of people. It was a bunch of friends in San Francisco and New York. And it, at a time when community, I mean, community is always important, but it was even more important because that was literally before the internet. And so it was really, you had to kind of be in contact with people and have parties and make staple together mimeographed magazines and such. And, you know, really what no one says when, everyone talks about this and everyone talks about the language poets, but what no one talks about is the fact that we were kids and we were in our 20s, literally in our 20s. You know, so now I look at that and I go, we were kids. Nobody says that. I mean, no, they don't say it either, my cohorts. But it was very intense, and, you know, I think that, and I still know some of those people, and I'm still friendly with some of them. Some of them I'm not. Some of them have kind of stopped writing. Some of them are still writing, but I just, you know, they've scattered. And I still know Charles Bernstein and Linda Ginian and Ron Silliman. And they're an important part of my life, and I think that in terms of what they did or what we did, I was not exactly the leading theorist of it, but is sort of to break down the dominant paradigm at that time, which was, you know, very kind of autobiographical poetry that was not very intellectually ambitious or open. So. You know, I think that, I mean, we weren't the only ones. Certainly they were the second generation. New York School were also active, and other people too, but people like us were sort of, you know, just doing something so different that it was getting a certain amount of attention, and it was showing that something different could be done. You know, not all poetry had to look a certain way, because it had begun to feel that it did.
Do you find, looking back, when you were growing up and getting involved and having these friends and these groups, mm-hmm. that there was more of a committed intensity than you find now? That life never been easy, but
well,
still.
Than I find now, but you know, than I
all
find.
All of us find
but,
now.
But you know, I don't know about all of us. I know, I mean, you know, kids probably still find the same intensity with each other. Young artists, I imagine they do. There are probably some of you out there. I think that's the nature of youth. And, you know, that was an intense time because it was the Vietnam War and all of that, but it's an intense time now, too. Look what's going on, you know? Black Lives Matter, the Trump thing. It's very intense. So, you know, I think when we get older, we tend to we see things come and go in waves, and we might get a little bit jaded, maybe, but... I don't think intensity is dead. I'm not young, so I can't speak for the young, but I think, you know, I want to listen to them. That's the diplomatic answer, but it's true. It's true. No, I think it's true.
Yes.
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 Yes. Yes. Okay, anybody else?
I wonder if you know what I, if
from way back when.
Way back when I
liked John Donne quite a lot. You know, from more recently, I like Keats. You know, who doesn't like Keats?
I like him,
and then there's Emily Dickinson is my great hero, but that's more, that's a lot more recent than Shakespeare, and it's practically modern.
Blake,
absolutely. Okay, anybody else? All right. Oh, one, okay, good.
Okay. I was just gonna ask, how much do you revise a poem before you consider it finished?
It really varies. Often quite a bit, often a lot, but not always, you know, sometimes only a little. But it, you know, it takes me, usually it takes me days, maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks to write a poem of it. And when I'm writing a lot. I mean, I'm spending a lot of time per day on it. So, yeah, I tear things up a lot and go back to them. I mean, I think revision is actually interesting in the way that translation is interesting. I know it's when people are starting out, they really hate it because they hate to, you know, they think that they had this perfect inspiration, which can happen, but it, you know, it can happen, but it probably didn't. You know?
I was reading Just Saying recently, mm-hmm. and I found that a lot of the poems either had a very tied up ending where they kind of were circular and started with the beginning and came around to the end, and then the other, many of them were very open
mm-hmm.
at the end in a way that I kind of blew through them all, and I was I found it very fast and also unsatisfying at times with the endings.
Okay.
Why?
why did end that way, or why did you find it
unsatisfying?
I'm going to answer the first question. Well, I think that I hope that people will see things as unresolved and keep thinking about them, I guess.
Yeah.
Because if I really understand something thoroughly, I'm finished with it and I probably don't write about it. So I write about things that I'm still thinking about. So I kind of write to the point where I don't know, and then I'm still thinking, and I want you to think too, I guess.
That's a very satisfactory answer.
anybody else? Okay. All right, well, they have copies of this beautiful book, which has a boy on it. So I'm going to be signing them back there if anyone would like to stop by and get a copy and get it signed. Okay. Thanks for coming.